Well, my congressman is Richie Neal. He's here with us today in the First District of Massachusetts. Okay. I voted for him delightedly. Think that we are so lucky to have you, Richie. I guess the first thing I want to know is there a chance, is there an outside chance that the House of Representatives can go Democratic the next time out, 2018?
I do. I believe that there is a reasonable chance, largely because the 25-seat differential has to highlight the idea that there are 24 congressional seats across the country where Hillary Clinton won and that are now held by Republicans. So I think that the blowback because of the Trump administration is going to be helpful in terms of constituting a new majority. I think we've had unanticipated success in Georgia, for example, in a congressional seat that has not been on the Republican side since on the Democratic side since Newt Gingrich won it decades ago. And I think that right now the wind is at our back, and whether or not you can get to the 25 is always a challenge based upon the DNA of the individual congressional districts across the country. But the efforts that we've made, the candidates that are being enticed to join the race, and the money that has been raised, I think, makes us competitive, plus the fact that I think that President Trump, who is polling in the high 30s, could in large measure be detrimental to Republican congressional candidates across the country.
And that's always been the history, right, in the
off elections. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess I want to ask you, you recently gave a little come to the throne lecture to your fellow Democrats about not looking down their noses at people in other districts who have different political philosophies, Democrats, than theirs. And what was that about?
Well, it's very simple, and that is that the issue is called arithmetic. We now, in the House of Representatives, as Democrats, can say accurately that one-third of our roster in the entire House of Representatives now comes from Massachusetts, New York, and California. And that is dissimilar to the party that I signed up for and went to the House to support back in 1988 when there were 269 Democrats. Today there are 194. And we cannot go into these election cycles saying that we forfeit the entire old Confederacy, that we now forfeit the border regions of the country, the southern states, and that we've now seen West Virginia, which was solidly Democratic at one time, slip away. Arkansas, which was solidly Democratic, it has slipped away. And for us to try to figure out the arithmetic, where do you go to get another seat in Massachusetts? You're not going to get another seat in Connecticut. You're going to have trouble getting more seats in New York and California. So I'm arguing for a bigger tent theory, a center-left party that promotes economic growth, acknowledges that we are the party of cultural change, that we leave some room for individuals who want to be Democrats, but they find that they can't be on script with every single Democratic issue that is important to people in California, Massachusetts, and New York. So I think that you're going to find Democrats of different stripes, and I just want to say this very clearly. We have stared down the Republican effort to undo the Affordable Care Act. But what's left out of the argument is that the Affordable Care Act passed because of the people I've just described. Rahm Emanuel did a great job during those years of recruiting Democrats based upon the DNA of their individual congressional districts. And they were the ones that fell on the sword after voting for the ACA. But we at that time had a majority of Democrats in Ohio and Pennsylvania. They voted for the Affordable Care Act. We even had a majority of Democrats in Mississippi at that time. And I think that this conversation, as we narrow the base so that we can find ourselves in this position of having a smaller but more vocal constituency, means that you don't achieve the things that we're interested in getting done, like defending Social Security and Medicare, like defending Medicaid, and pointing out that the ACA now insures 22 million more people than it did. That was done with a Democratic majority in the House and in the Senate and with a Democratic president.
Talk to me about the gerrymander, which takes us there. This conversation takes us there. Legislatures, which draw the lines, sometimes federal judges, but most of the time, legislatures draw the lines. They draw them in their own self-interest. The Republicans have taken many of these legislatures. How do we get around that?
Well, through four legislative cycles now, Democrats have lost 67 seats in the House of Representatives. We have lost, I believe, 15 seats in the United States Senate. We have lost more than 1,000 legislative seats across the country. And right now, as you and I speak, there are 33 legislative bodies in America that are Republican. And to get back into the business of winning, we're going to need to elect some Democratic legislators. We're going to need to elect some Democratic governors who then will have some say on what congressional districts look like. And the position that the Republicans took for many years was to invest heavily in efforts to gerrymander congressional districts across the country. And it has worked for them. I mean, when you consider that we have four Democrats in Pennsylvania, I believe four in Ohio, and in North Carolina, it should be 7-6 one way or the other instead of, I believe, it's now 9-4. So those are areas where they went out and ruthlessly used the computer to redraw congressional districts that are exclusively devoted to their success. And it was recently mentioned in an article I read in North Carolina where an individual who wrote the law simply said, if we could have done this to one more Democrat and gotten away with it, we would have. And it's the result of a very sophisticated, orchestrated effort to tailor-make these districts for Republicans across the country.
One of the curses of the computer. Oh, great computer, draw me lines where we can't
lose.
Right.
And the better point is that we all saw the computer based upon the Carr decision of the Supreme Court, one man, one vote, or we should say one person, one vote, that the Carr decision that took place, we all saw as a revolution in terms of a correct proportional Democratic representation across the country. We now find that the computer draws these lines in many cases, and the computer allows individuals, as they submit data and information with legislative majorities, to do pretty much whatever they want, because the courts do look to the computer in as a reflection of how much effort has been put into drawing these districts.
And don't even talk to me about Texas.
That's correct. I mean, I thought that one of the most Machiavellian moments in my time was, at that time, Tom DeLay's decision to, after redistricting had occurred, to wait 4 years and go out and redistrict Texas once more. And what he did was he clearly changed those congressional districts. But the truth is that even with the court challenges and the continuing challenge that's in front of the courts of Texas, and eventually I expect the Supreme Court to reflect on that decision, it is important to remember those districts have held.
On a completely different subject, I know you've been working for four decades on the renovation of Union Station in Springfield. I wonder, are you a happy man now?
I'm thrilled. I think that we saved a spectacular old building. It's been closed for 43 years. It was once the centerpiece of rail transportation, east-west and north-south. I think part of the attending success is the decision of Governor Malloy in Connecticut to move forward with improving rail from New Haven to Hartford and on to Springfield and headed north again to Vermont. And there are going to be, I believe, anywhere from 8 to 12 more trains a day beginning in the next year and a half or so. And Union Station has been there, and it's been idle. It's 90 years old, but of those 90 years, 43 have been represented by a closed building. It's a great landmark. Anybody who remembers Union Station, including many members of the military who traveled to World War II and to Korea and to Vietnam from there, I think that it grips their nostalgia. But also, I think that it has a very practical application going forward as a transportation hub. So I announced my candidacy for the Springfield City Council there 40 years ago, and I indicated at that time that that was going to be one of my priorities. Took a little bit longer than I'd anticipated, Alan, but nonetheless, this, I think, June 23rd, 24th, and 25th is going to celebrate the reopening of this destination.
As long as you've mentioned Governor Malloy, I have a question for you. I'm getting a certain amount of mail at the radio station about from people who really want to get from the Berkshires to New York City. And I believe that there's a way of doing that, but that the Connecticut people have been putting a little bit of a stop to that.
Well, there is. And there's also, I think, there should be an effort collectively. And I know I've talked to legislators and mayors across Western Massachusetts that if Massachusetts is to go forward on a study with linking North Station to South Station, the Green Line from Somerville to Medford and down through Fall River, then certainly consideration ought to be given from Worcester to Springfield and onto the Berkshires. And I've talked to the governor about Governor Baker about this and feel very strongly about it. I think that those of us across the state who witnessed the big dig, $22 billion later, many of our plans were inconvenienced. And also another very important consideration, plans were put on hold. Some were canceled, all to pay for the big dig. And I look now at some of the expenditures that I see in the Boston area, and there's a bigger Commonwealth than just Greater Boston. And I'm hopeful that we can convince Governor Baker, who's been very good to work with on this so far, that East-West Rail, including a link all the way through the Berkshires, we should begin to plan for that right now.
That would be fabulous. Why is he so popular? Why is Governor Baker so popular?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, it's in the arithmetic, and the arithmetic says that 55% of the voters in Massachusetts are suburban independents. About 33% are Democrats, and about 12% are Republicans. And I think the success that Republicans have in Massachusetts has largely come from the fact that they offer an alignment to suburban independent voters. They keep the base of the Republican Party, and they pick up enough disgruntled, frequently urban Democrats to put them over the top. And I think that Governor Baker has adopted positions that appeal to suburban independent voters. And they are, after all, one of the most important elements in getting elected in Massachusetts. And they also, interestingly enough, as I've pointed out in the past, they see no inconsistency in voting for Ted Kennedy and Bill Weld on the same day.
And do you think, and then we only have time for this last mini question, but do you think that there is a Democrat around who could successfully beat Baker now?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about an election that's so far off, who knows? But I do know that right now that Governor Baker is very popular in across western Massachusetts and certainly inside the 495 Beltway where the elections tend to be decided.
Okay, last question. You're the smartest guy I know in Congress, so I want to ask you a question. If they came to you and said, Richie Neal, we'd like you to be our vice presidential candidate, would you do it?
Well, obviously, when opportunity knocks, you're going to consider it. Ambition is ambition, and I think that it's no different in seeking a Pulitzer Prize or a Nobel Prize or winning a gold medal in the Olympics. I think that in politics, one of the fascinating parts about it today is it's the only place, I think, in American life where experience is held against you.
It's always great to talk to our good friend, Richie Neal, my congressman from the 1st District of Massachusetts, a Democrat, and the ranking member, not the smelliest, but the top member of the Ways and Means Committee. Richie, thanks so much for joining us. When we come back the next time, we'll figure out something else to talk about.
Delighted to be with you, Alan.